Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 6th of October, these are our main stories. It's now emerged that the French police worker who killed four colleagues in Paris followed a radical version of Islam, but did nobody notice recent changes in his behaviour? Pope Francis creates 13 new cardinals. Is the pontiff trying to secure his legacy? And the Russian government says a British man arrested 9 months ago was caught red-handed as a spy. But where's the evidence? It's no joke, say critics of the new film Joker, because they fear it could incite violence.
Very rapidly, this kind of backlash began about, no, it's irresponsible, it's nasty, it's cynical, it's something which is pretending to be better than it is.
And they had to wait more than a century to mark their Thanksgiving festival in the capital. But this year, the Oromo in Ethiopia celebrated in Addis Ababa. But first, when details emerged about the deadly knife attack at police headquarters in the French capital Paris on Thursday, it was initially classified as a criminal act by a man with possible psychological problems. But now it's emerged the attacker followed a radical version of Islam. Mikhail Arpong, who worked in police intelligence tackling Islamist extremism, killed four co-workers before being shot dead. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield told me more about what we're learning about Mikhail Arpong.
We've had a press conference given by the anti-terrorist chief prosecutor, a man called Jean-François Ricard, and what we learned is that this man, Mikhail Arpong, well, A, he converted to Islam 10 years ago, nothing wrong with that, but in recent months he'd started acting in a much more reserved fashion towards women. He said he didn't want to come in contact with women. He'd started at his mosque in Gonesse in northern Paris, started wearing not Western clothes but Arab-style jalabas. People in his entourage said they'd heard him defending various attacks committed by Islamic State, so-called, and others. And now we know also that in the hours running up to the attack, he was exchanging SMS text messages with his partner, also was a woman of a very religious nature, all of which is, of course, creating a picture of a man who was, in fact, gradually becoming a very, very radical Muslim.
And it seems unbelievable, doesn't it, that this man was working at the heart of police intelligence, looking at Islamist radicalism in the Paris region. I mean, how are there no signs that he, you know, he was becoming radicalised himself?
How indeed? That is the question which everyone is asking. So it really is the worst possible scenario. And, you know, really, people are not just grieving, but they are obviously also, well, furious that this can have happened. And, well, I mean, there are calls for a parliamentary commission of inquiry. There are calls for the resignation of the interior minister, Christophe Castaner. I don't think they'll come to anything, but clearly there's been a huge fault in intelligence and in systems that allowed this man, who was a backroom person, maybe, but he still had access to all kinds of information and was at the heart of the police operation. And yet, throughout this, he was a man who was gradually radicalising and eventually tipped into this ghastly act.
And in the immediate aftermath of the attack, police were very keen to say that it wasn't terrorism, weren't they? They said that he was this great employee that had just turned almost in a moment of madness. What's been the reaction to that?
Presumably, people who knew him knew that he was a convert to Islam, but as everyone at the time said, so what? It doesn't mean that it wasn't just an act of madness by a man with a grudge, maybe, or someone with a psychological weakness. The fact that he converted to Islam was not necessarily a factor in any of this. It turns out it was, but at the beginning, I think people were justifiably cautious about that.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Now to the Vatican.
Venerable brothers, we create and solemnly announce you as cardinals of the Holy Roman Church.
Pope Francis has created 13 new cardinals at a time when his leadership is under fire from conservatives within his own church. Many criticise him openly. Our reporter John McManus has been telling me more about these new cardinals and what impact their appointment could have.
These men range from the Archbishop of Rabat in Morocco, Cristobal Lopez Romero, Spanish-born, but in that part of the world, based there for many years and noted for improving Christian-Muslim relations. There's also a Czechoslovakian-born priest who's the Pope's right-hand man on the issue of migrants. You probably remember those pictures of the Pope visiting migrant centres, another cause that's very close to his heart, and also the Archbishop of Kinshasa. So men from all over the world. What's really noticeable, though, is that there's nobody from one of the richest parts of the global church. That's the United States, which has traditionally given a lot of money to the Vatican and also been a source of political power. No Americans. There is one British man who's been appointed who's from Liverpool, but he's over the age of 80 and so won't be able to vote for the next pope because the age limit is 79.
Yes, so the majority of these new cardinals, they will be able to vote for the new pope, won't they? So could we see the next pope being very similar to Pope Francis?
This is what the pope's critics and also his supporters are saying, that he is moving the direction of the church and the focus of the College of Cardinals, this group of elected cardinals, in a way that will almost certainly mean that the next pope after him will be similar to Pope Francis and have very many of the same concerns. What does this mean? Well, if we look at the last pope, Pope Benedict, he was very happy to have in some ways a much smaller church as long as the Catholics within it obeyed the rules more closely. Francis is the exact opposite. He wants a larger church where people who in the past may not have been so welcome, I'm thinking about people who've been divorced and remarried, perhaps gay couples, those who find it difficult to have a voice in the secular world as well as the church, they are made more welcome. That's where the Pope is going. And by these appointments, he's now appointed more than half of the men who will vote for his successor. That's the direction it appears to be moving in.
He's going that direction, but a lot of conservatives within the Vatican are not happy about that at all. What's been their reaction to these appointments?
Well, Cardinal Raymond Burke, who's a US cardinal, is the leader, if you like, of the faction within the Vatican that is really very much opposed to Pope Francis's moves in terms of theology, but also where the political power actually is. And in terms of what their reaction is, well, have a look at something that's happening at the Vatican where they're instituting something called the Amazon Synod, where they're going to look at issues around the Amazon base and particularly Brazil. One of those is what you do about the huge shortage of priests there. There just aren't enough to minister and hold masses for people. One of the suggestions in the working document is that they ordain married men. Now, that's usually a big no-no in the Catholic Church, and many traditionalists like Cardinal Burke are furious about it. But these are the kind of suggestions that are being discussed under Francis that would never have seen the light of day under Pope Benedict, or indeed the Pope before, John Paul II.
That was John McManus. Pro-democracy protesters, many of them wearing masks, have staged a march in Hong Kong in defiance of a new ban on face coverings. The metro system remained closed on Saturday after a day of violent rallies, and many shops and businesses were unable to open. The embattled chief executive, Carrie Lam, urged all people to reject violence.
The extreme actions of rioters created a very dark night for Hong Kong and made Hong Kong society semi-paralyzed. Everyone is very worried and concerned, or even scared. The government will suppress violence with the greatest determination. I appeal to everyone to support the government in suppressing violence in accordance to the law, condemn violence together, and cut ties with rioters with a firm will.
Our correspondent in Hong Kong, Robin Brandt, described the mood there as night fell.
There was a single protest march with a few thousand participants. But so far there's been no confrontation with the police. Hong Kong is a calmer city tonight, but it's a city plagued by paralysis, according to its embattled political leader Carrie Lam. The entire metro system remained shut today after it was suspended yesterday. Banks and other businesses associated with the Chinese mainland were also closed, fearing renewed attacks by some demonstrators. But the ban on face masks has been roundly ignored. This woman was among a crowd of a few hundred who gathered in the central district this evening.
This is motivation for us to go, and this will not... We were not afraid of this law.
Almost all were in black clothes and very many covering half their face with a mask. A criminal act now in Hong Kong.
Robin Brandt on the streets of Hong Kong. The British family of a man accused of spying in Moscow has called on the government in London to do more to secure his release. Paul Whelan, who also has American, Irish and Canadian citizenship, was arrested in December when Russia claimed he was caught red-handed with state secrets. 9 months later, though, investigators have still not produced any evidence of that. Sarah Rainsford reports from Moscow.
My work has never included Defense Department interaction. Human rights violations abound.
Paul Whelan stands in a cage guarded by men in balaclavas and proclaims his innocence to a Moscow courtroom.
This case is an absurd provocation.
9 months ago, just after he was arrested and accused of spying, he told me he was scared to speak out. But when I last saw him in court, Mr. Whelan claimed he'd been set up by Russia's FSB security service. By then, he was so frustrated, he shouted over the judge.
This is a dog and pony show.
He's also described himself as a hostage, fearing he's caught up in some bigger political game here.
So obviously they went to the States and then they were forwarded on.
Many miles away in Lincolnshire, England, his relatives are worried. Mark Whelan shows me letters they've received from Paul, whose parents are from Birmingham.
It is literally just chitter-chatter.
Paul himself was born after the family moved to Canada. He later moved again to the United States and served in the Marines. To Mark Whelan, though, it's simple. His cousin is in trouble and he thinks the UK government should do more to help.
There should be condemnation of these actions. If a British citizen is being ill-treated or he's not being afforded access to international law, then the British government should stand up and say, this is not right. Why is this happening?
It was just after Christmas last year that Paul Whelan was arrested at the Metropole Hotel close to the Kremlin. He'd visited Russia several times, even brought his parents. This time, he'd come for a wedding. But as he was dressing, he says an old friend showed up uninvited. Moments later, the FSB burst in and arrested him. The Russian government say Mr. Whelan was caught red-handed with a drive containing state secrets. He and his lawyers believe that was planted by his friend for the FSB.
When you heard that he'd been accused of spying, what went through your head?
No, this is ridiculous. Utterly ridiculous. You're automatically transported into some kind of James Bond, Jason Bourne mindset because it's the stuff of movies. This isn't my cousin. This isn't Paul.
You don't think there's any chance ex-military, went to Russia a lot, knew people with military background, you don't think there can be anything in it?
No, categorically. There are people who travel all around the world who will have friends in the military in different countries. It doesn't make them a spy.
There's a couple of security guards here outside Lefortovo prison and the American ambassador's car just drawing up, the flag flying on the front, and he's pulling up for a visit now to see Paul Whelan here, one of the regular consular visits that he gets.
British diplomats visit too, and a Foreign Office spokesperson said the government does raise its concerns about Mr. Whelan's detention with the Russian authorities, calling on them to respect his human rights. The US, though, through its ambassador, has taken a harder line. This was John Huntsman's third visit, and after 90 minutes, he emerged from the prison to say this.
I call on the Russian government to immediately release Paul based on his deteriorating health, based upon the lack of any evidence whatsoever. Then we've heard from the Russian government that he was caught red-handed. If there was any evidence to that end, Paul would have seen it, and certainly his lawyer would have seen it, but we have seen nothing.
Paul Whelan in court has described himself as a political hostage. What do you make of that statement?
Well, I don't think it serves any purpose to speculate on the politics or the specifics of this case other than to say there has been no evidence.
The US ambassador is leaving Russia now, though. This was his last act in the post. And he goes just as FSB investigators have handed over their files to the defence lawyers. Paul Whelan's trial is expected to begin in a few months. The sentence for espionage here is up to 20 years behind bars.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Still to come on this podcast, why a judge in Thailand shot himself shortly before he was due to deliver a verdict. After a few hours of relative calm, violence returned to the streets of the Iraqi capital Baghdad on Saturday, with at least five more people killed in clashes between anti-government protesters and the police. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher told me more.
Well, what we saw was a calmer situation in Baghdad through the morning into the early afternoon. A big mobilisation of security again. A slight softening, a sense there might have been some softening from the government having used very repressive measures against the protest in the first 4 days of a protest. There was apparently, at least the look of an attempt to try to speak to them, to try to address their issues. But the main focus of that, which is an emergency meeting at the parliament, which had been convened, never actually transpired. Two of the major blocs didn't show up. The Speaker of Parliament did speak about the protest, did make some promises about giving money to small businesses, but not amounting to very much. And we've seen just in the past couple of hours, people come out onto the streets again. The curfew was lifted and there's been violence again. At least five people have been killed. The reports we've been having, there's been potentially sniper fire from security forces. The police have been using rubber bullets and tear gas. At the moment, it doesn't look like it's degenerated into the kind of all-out violence we've seen over the past few nights, but we'll have to wait and see.
And this is the worst unrest now since Islamic State were defeated in 2017. What's behind it?
It is. Well, essentially, these are perennial issues. These are the issues that, in a sense, led to the rise of ISIS, the fact that people across Iraq feel the government hasn't done anything for them, but they're forgotten. Unemployment is rampant. Corruption is rampant. But these are taking place in areas where ISIS didn't have such a stronghold. These are in Baghdad and in Shia areas further south. What I've heard from some of the people further north in the areas that were held by ISIS is people don't actually want to go out on the streets at the moment because they feel they might be targeted with the brush of ISIS, but they're rising up again. So they're frightened of that. But these are issues that have, you know, come back again and again. And no government that has been in power in Iraq has so far shown any ability to deal with them.
Sebastian Usher. Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, the Oromo, have been allowed to celebrate their annual Thanksgiving festival in the capital, Addis Ababa. It's the first time in more than 100 years they've been allowed to do so. Singing, dancing and colourful costumes were all part of the celebrations. Mary Harper, our Africa regional editor, told me more about them.
The Oromo people, who make up the largest section of Ethiopia's population, there are about 40 million of them out of about 105 million Ethiopians. Even though their land, their territory, completely encircles Addis Ababa, they've had to have their festivals outside the capital for more than actually 150 years, because they've been quite marginalised by other ethnic groups. So today was a pretty momentous occasion for them to be able to have their main religious festival, their Thanksgiving festival, for the end of the rainy season, the beginning of the harvest, and that to take place in Addis Ababa, which is a territory that they see as rightfully theirs.
And there are concerns, aren't there, that the festival will lead to nationalism, though, the rise of nationalism?
Yes, there are some concerns, because the Oromos now have been basically on the rise. In 2015, they started protesting against the small ethnic group that was dominating politics, the Tigrayans. And they basically said that we've had enough of this, and they managed to eventually see the transition of power to an Oromo prime minister. And some of the people at the festival today were quite a series of mixed emotions. Some people were very excited and talking in quite joyful tones. Others were actually being quite political, as if finally the Oromo's turn has come.
I wish for unity and love in our country. I hope we will come together and everyone can celebrate the festival. We have to grow our culture and show it to the world.
This is founded on the blood of Oromo's young people. We have sacrificed so many young people to achieve these reforms. The Oromo need to make sure the reforms continue.
And do you think this festival will be back in the capital next year?
It's very likely that it will. It would be difficult for the authorities to turn around and say you can't have it in Addis Ababa anymore. But one does wonder what the other ethnic groups who for so long held power in Ethiopia, for example, the Amhara ethnic group, they dominated the imperial period, and then the Tigrayans dominated the sort of dictatorial period that followed. And they're probably not going to be very happy that they see their capital city, which is very mixed ethnically. It's a huge, growing metropolis, very international as well. And they won't be delighted to see the Oromos kind of treating it as their unique territory, not really belonging to anybody else. And that's probably why during the festivities, which were very cheerful and full of singing and flower waving and dipping grass in water and things like that, at the same time there was a massive security presence. Even snipers apparently were posted. So it shows that even though this was an occasion for people to celebrate, there were concerns about security.
Mary Harper. A judge in Thailand has shot himself in court shortly before he was due to hand down a verdict. Miraculously, he survived and is being treated in hospital. But the case has highlighted serious concerns about the independence of Thai judges. Celia Hatton is our Asia Pacific editor.
This judge, he's a lower court judge, and he was due to issue a verdict in a case that involved murder and weapons charges. There were five people who he had to decide their fates, basically. Three of them were up for the death penalty if they'd been found guilty, and two would have been sentenced to very lengthy jail terms. Witnesses say he pulled out a pistol, shot himself in the chest, and then was taken to hospital. He's now apparently in stable condition. It then emerged that he'd released quite a lengthy statement online, basically outlining his problems with this case. And he basically accused higher level judges, his supervisors, of trying to intervene in his decision. And he called this out. He said in the document, "If I cannot keep my oath of office, I'd rather die than live without honor." Thai law says that if a lower court judge is not confident about the evidence presented in a case, that he can ignore the advice of his supervisors and issue the verdict that he wants to issue, he or she. In this case, this judge simply felt that he didn't have that ability to do that.
That was Celia Hatton. Joker, the latest film from the DC Comics universe, has just opened in cinemas. But it's dividing opinion, and not just with critics. There's also concerns it could inspire copycat attacks in the US. Richard Hamilton has the story.
Joaquin Phoenix in the title role, his chilling performance as a mentally unhinged outcast who finds fame through an act of violence, has been widely praised. Last month it won the Golden Lion for Best Film at the Venice Festival, where it received an 8-minute standing ovation. But while some critics have been grinning from ear to ear, not all of them are amused. Here in Britain, the newspapers are deeply divided, with The Telegraph calling it dangerously good, but The Guardian describing it as the most disappointing film of the year. Mark Kermode reviews movies for the BBC.
It's hard to remember a mainstream movie in recent history that has provoked such sort of wildly varying reactions. So it played, you know, a film festival in which it got a rapturous response and won big prizes, and there was all these kind of five-star reviews, people being knocked out by it. And then very rapidly, this kind of backlash began about, no, it's irresponsible, it's nasty, it's cynical, it's something which is pretending to be better than it is. So when the first audiences saw it, they had fairly low expectations and were kind of astonished. And when the later audiences saw it, they read all the glowing reviews and were not astonished. And this weirdly kind of polarised very quickly. Bear in mind, the film is only opening now, and we're already beginning to see the lash against the backlash.
But there are more serious concerns in the United States, where the joke has been criticised for having the potential to incite violence and bringing back memories of a mass shooting in a Colorado movie theatre. In 2012, a gunman opened fire on the audience during a midnight screening of the Batman film The Dark Knight Rises. He killed 12 people and injured 70 others. Some of their families have expressed deep reservations about this new film. Police in New York, Los Angeles and Chicago said they would deploy additional officers to locations playing the Joker. At the New York Film Festival on Wednesday night, police officers armed with assault rifles stood outside and people had their bags searched. Plainclothes policemen were also stationed inside some cinemas. Two of America's largest theatre chains have banned costumes and face masks, and one cinema in California actually cancelled screenings altogether after police said they'd received credible threats.
Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.